Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Dozman. The election of Donald Trump in 2016 shocked and surprised a number of commentators, especially because his own attitudes seem to be in conflict with much of what people often associate with conservatism. However, my guest today, Matt McManus, argues that Trump and others represent a new form of conservatism, one with a long history of development informed as a response to various social dynamics. The goal of his recent book, The Rise of Postmodern Conservatism, from Palgrave Macmillan in 2020, is to provide a genealogical analysis of this new form of conservative politics. Matt McManus received his PhD from the Socio-Legal Studies Program at York University, Canada, in 2017. He is currently a visiting professor of political science and international relations at the University of Tec de Monterrey, Mexico, and is also the author of Making Human Dignity Central to International Human Rights Law, A Critical Legal Argument. So, Matt McManus, welcome back to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So, to start things off, we always like to kind of have our authors introduce themselves. So, could you tell us a bit about yourself and what your research tends to focus on?
Sure. So, I graduated from York University with my degree in Social Legal Studies in the summer of 2017. And after a brief stint doing postdoctoral research on the legal problems of low-income families and working for the Committee for International Justice and Accountability, I took up my present position at Tec de Monterrey, where I've been for the last 2 years. And my research has two prongs. One is a more constructive prong, putting forward a normative argument for what I call a critical legal approach to human dignity, centered around democratizing society and establishing more egalitarian distributions of goods and honors. And the other prong of my research tends to be much more critical. It analyzes various forms of reactionary politics and tries to situate the account of human dignity that I've been developing in my more constructive work within a increasingly fragmented and dangerous geopolitical context.
All right. So this book begins by looking at some recent surprise movements in elections as a sort of debunking of Fukuyama's end of history thesis. While this is simplifying a lot of both your and Fukuyama's positions, I think it's the core of what you get at in the first pages of your book. So I'm wondering if you can start by unpacking our current social and political moment as you understand it at the beginning of this book.
Sure. I should say there's a personal dimension to this work that's related to the Fukuyama thesis. So I was born in 1988, just around the time when the Cold War was coming to an end, and end of history rhetoric was really gaining a lot of traction. And I more or less came of age in that kind of situation. The first really grand historical event I recall being vividly aware of was the 9/11 attacks when I was in grade 8. But the interesting thing about Fukuyama's book is it was never as dogmatic and kind of monological as is sometimes applied. At the end of the book, he talks about why it is that the yearning for recognition and history that some individuals have, particularly individuals on the political right, and he brings up Donald Trump, pathetically enough, might actually lead to the resuscitation of history as a kind of dominant logic that we're living through. And of course, that's more or less what's happened. So I don't want to imply that I'm just sitting here criticizing Fukuyama like so many others have. I think there's actually a lot of interesting things in this book. But what I'm talking about, what I say is that the rebirth of history with the emergence of postmodern conservatism resulted from developments within modernity and now postmodernity that have very deep roots in our cultural traditions. And we need to appreciate these deep roots if we're going to try to understand why we live in the moment that we do right now. And of course, if you're a progressive, how to push against it.
Moving on, you introduced postmodernism, which is a difficult term, partly because it has been used to describe movements in art, literature, and philosophy, although there seem to be some kind of core elements to it. So could you give us kind of a brief primer or introduction to postmodern theory as you understand it here?
Sure. Well, in the book, I make a typological distinction between those who understand postmodernism as a theoretical position and those who understand postmodernism as a cultural condition, which is the way that I approach it. And usually it's only the first that's given significant attention, certainly by the right-wing media. So postmodern theory is a novel form of epistemic skepticism that emerged typically starting in the 1960s with people like Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault. Later you could add people like Richard Rorty during some of his time periods, Gayatri Spivak, and others. And it's a novel form of epistemic skepticism focusing more on the limitations of language to either holistically or positivistically picture the world as it actually is. And there are a lot of different dimensions to it. Some of it is interesting. I personally am unconvinced by most forms of epistemic skepticism. And I should say, ultimately, postmodern theory has kind of had its heyday. And I think it's actually starting to decline in popularity across the university, even in progressive circles. You know, you see people like Alain Berger, Slavoj Žižek, Robert Brandom on the analytical tradition, who all push pretty staunchly against the idea that we should embrace the kind of deep epistemic skepticism that postmodern theorists in their heyday like to put forward. The way that I tend to approach postmodernism isn't as a skeptical theory, but as what I call a cultural condition. And when I mean a cultural condition, I'm drawing on the research of people like Jean-François Lyotard, who's probably most well-known for his book, The Postmodern Condition, David Harvey, Mark Fisher, Frederick Jameson, and all of them point out that what postmodern theorists did wasn't so much develop new forms of epistemic skepticism as capture this cultural condition in thought in a rather Hegelian way. And this is important because they're going to say epistemic skepticism isn't just the purview of a certain number of eclectic French academics now. That's becoming more and more a ubiquitous outlook that many different individuals hold to. And this has ramifications in art, in literature, in philosophy, certainly, and in politics. And I say, once we appreciate that postmodernity is a cultural condition rather than just a theory, you can appreciate why it would be inevitable that not only would this impact left-wing politics, and it has in certain interesting ways, but this form of epistemic skepticism would also impact various forms of right-wing politics. And this has given birth to the novel political tradition that I call postmodern conservatism.
Yeah, kind of jumping off of that, one thing you find interesting, you mentioned that the relationship between conservatism and postmodernism. You find that conservatives are often critical of postmodern theory, although they rarely make the connection many theorists do between postmodern culture and late capitalist development. But you argue that there seems to be a relationship between the two, that late capitalist societies often produce postmodern cultures, and that postmodern culture is a sort of expression of the dynamics of late capitalism. So can you unpack the connection between these two dynamics?
Yeah, absolutely. I should point out that one of the things that conservative theory, particularly in the 1990s, was prone to doing, and has a long history of this, is naturalizing capitalism as a kind of ubiquitous way of life that's been with us for all time, and it has deep roots, even in something as foundational as human nature. And this isn't the way that even 18th century political economists would understand it. If you read, you know, The Wealth of Nations, or even David Ricardo's book on Principles of Political Economy, they're well aware of the fact that they're living in a time period where something really radically new is emerging. And it's exciting and interesting because the emergence of capitalism is disruptive. It opens new spaces for interrogating issues that weren't available before. But it's also frightening, of course, since the new can never be predicted and never be controlled the way something that's traditional and known can. And Marx put this very well, Marx and Engels, I should say, in the Communist Manifesto, when they talk about how capitalism is a revolutionary mode of production that's literally melting all that is solid into the air and profaning all that was once taken as holy. And what they talk about in this book, and other more sophisticated commentators have described, is how capitalism operates according to a logic of what's called creative destruction, according to somebody like Schumpeter, right? It tears down the old in order to make way for the new. And this includes old capitalist firms over a long enough time period. But it also includes societies, right? It changes the way that people think about themselves, it changes the way they relate to others, it changes the way we understand labor and the rights of laborers, for instance, to migration, and fosters urbanization and pluralism at the expense of ruralism and traditionalism. And the list goes on in a number of ways. It radically upends our society. And the connection of this to postmodern culture is manifold. Right. One, of course, is the sense that by tearing down the old and replacing it with the new, traditions and ways of thinking about things that are commonsensical no longer have time to ossify and become commonsensical the way they once were. You know, you can't sit there, if you want to put simply, and anticipate even what kind of life you're going to be living in 20 years from now, because new technologies and new forms of organization might totally upend it. It also means that people tend to approach the world in the way that a consumer approaches whether or not to buy a commodity or buy something at the store, right? It's up to you what kind of chocolate bar, ice cream, or vegetables you want to buy when you go into the grocery store. And increasingly, people see it as up to them to decide what way they want to look at the world. And just like you can't sit there and tell a consumer that they've made a bad choice, it's up to them if they have the money. They can buy it. It's not up to epistemic elites to tell others how they should interpret the world or what's worth believing in.
To develop things a little more here, one of the ways you develop the relationship is in postmodernism's dynamism regarding space and time and are related to stabilizing at the level of identity. This has been explored in a variety of theoretical texts, such as those by David Harvey or Frederick Jameson, and you also find contemporary fiction and film, particularly science fiction, to be rather illustrative of some of these new dynamics. So can you unpack what you see happening at the level of, like, individual identity?
Yeah, I should say that I think the greatest postmodern theorist actually isn't a theorist at all. And if you really want to have a good understanding of what postmodernity is all about, just crack open any of Philip K. Dick's books, and he'll tell you. You know, he had a better handle on this than almost anyone else I can think of. Philip K. Dick being the author of classic texts like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, or The Man in the High Castle, or Scanner Darkly, and so on and so forth. But what I'm talking about when I talk about our changing relationships to space-time under conditions of postmodernity is obviously not a physical concept of space and time. You know, that's very well analyzed by contemporary physicists. What I'm talking about is our cultural understanding of space and time, and I should also say our social geographic experience of it. So one of the things that I point out is that in postmodern cultures, where the sense that the end of history had been reached emerged, we developed a very interesting relationship to time from a cultural standpoint, because earlier generations, particularly liberal generations, saw themselves as living in a historically very significant period. They were at the cusp of progressive developments that allowed them the freedom and the opportunities to remake the world. Postmodern subjects don't feel that way. Their relationship to time is that history is over, that it's not your place to try to radically change things too much. And so the concept of time that postmodern individuals tend to experience isn't historical. It's phenomenological. It's based on their own inward experience of the world. And this has consequences, of course, for how postmodern subjects understand freedom, because there is no history that they can be a part of, and they can't change the structure of society all that much. They're not free in a social sense. They're free only at the level of individual experience. And this, of course, is very amenable to the neoliberal logic that we've all been living under over the last 30 years. You don't tinker that much with social structures or the global neoliberal order. If you want to tinker with something, try to improve your own life. Clean your room, as one of the more famous reactionary commentators today has put it. The way that late capitalism shifts our lives geographically, or experience of geography, of course, is exactly the way that Marx and Engels described it in the Communist Manifesto. The world has been brought closer together by globalization. This has profoundly transformed the way that we live. And sometimes you can see it quite literally. Rural areas and the idea of the big country that was once so foundational, for instance, to the American imaginary, have all but disappeared and been replaced by increasingly claustrophobic urban spaces where we all inhabit because life is more efficient when you live in an urban space. Than when you live in a big country. It's also brought the world together in the sense of breaking down national and traditionalist barriers for the free movement of labor. So, of course, we know that modern developed countries are characterized by very high levels of migration. A lot of this is the legacy of the colonial time period, but we can put that aside. And this quite literally brings areas of the world, or at least cultural ways of experiencing the world, to people's doorsteps. In a way that's really unprecedented in the history of modern society. And this, of course, also changes our sense of geography. For many people, this is a positive development, since it means that we are now free to live anywhere without restrictions, such as the ones that would have been imposed on us for a very long period of time. But for others, particularly those in a more conservative bent, it's an extremely frightening thing, since it means the solid lifestyles and sense of place associated with those lifestyles that earlier generations would have enjoyed are liquefying in the face of new forms of difference and new forms of pluralism that are emerging very, very rapidly across the globe.
In response to some of these dynamics, numerous new theories or discourses have been produced to try and restabilize ourselves and our societies. However, you see these discourses, particularly liberalism, as having failed to bring about the restabilizing effects they were supposed to. So can you unpack the shortcomings here?
To the liberal standpoint, you mean?
Yeah, among others. You see that, or you kind of argue that there have been a number of attempts to kind of restabilize our social and social identities, I should say. But I remember you seem to think that some of these discourses failed to kind of deliver on the promises they made.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that I point out in my new book that I'm finishing right now called Liberalism and Liberal Rights. I should say that I'm broadly sympathetic to the liberal project, particularly as espoused by figures like Immanuel Kant or John Rawls. But I think the promise of liberalism to establish a society where all was treated as moral equals isn't what we have right now. What we have is a society where people are not treated as moral equals the way they should, according to liberalism interpreted it in its best light. What we have is a society where people are treated as potential competitors in an increasingly stratified hierarchy. And people under those conditions have rights to compete and to try to get to the top, but they have no right to expect a certain kind of treatment because they have any kind of intrinsic dignity or value. And I think that this is obviously going to generate a very conflict-ridden society, and one defined by profound new forms of alienation. And this is compounded, of course, because the neoliberal interpretation of what liberalism is supposed to be about is one where political freedom has very little meaning. And economic competition is virtually everything. And what you get in a situation where society is increasingly a hierarchy and a very competitive hierarchy, and people have very little political freedom to change this, are the forms of resentment and agitation that we're seeing increasingly defining modern politics. And there are some positive dimensions to this. I mean, I welcome the emergence of things like what I call liberal socialism in the work of Bernie Sanders, or sorry, the agitation of people like Bernie Sanders or other new congressmen like the Squad in the United States. But the other reaction to it is, of course, this form of postmodern conservatism, which I see as a regression to a pre-liberal mode of living.
Yeah, so that brings us finally to postmodern conservatism as a new attempt to kind of address the shortcomings you see in late capitalism. So this is obviously a very contemporary phenomena, but you trace its ideological origins in the writing of figures such as Edmund Burke, Joseph de Maistre, and a few others. So can you give us a sense of these very early intellectual origins?
Of course. And I should say right off the bat that I did not coin the neologism postmodern conservatism. To my knowledge, it began floating around as early as the 1990s in the work of people like Peter Lawler, who was actually a conservative political theorist who mainly focused on American political problems. But there were also other people who are characterized as postmodern conservatives, including Robert Bork, who appears in my book. A number of legal scholars applied the label to him at that point. What I do in my own book is argue that since postmodernity is a cultural condition rather than just a particular theoretical way of looking at the world, we shouldn't be surprised that we would see postmodern forms of conservatism emerging. If anything, it would be inevitable. We're all shaped in various ways by our culture and our society, and that includes conservatives. In fact, it might especially include conservatives. But what I point out is that conservatism was uniquely amenable to mutation under the conditions of postmodernity, because conservatives going back centuries have always been skeptical of the promises and the outlook of things like scientific or liberal rationalism or universalism. And you can see this in the work of people like Edmund Burke, who was extremely critical of elitist philosophes writing in France, or even the more hyper-liberal capitalists of his own time, who he saw as having little respect for tradition, little respect for culturally relative ways of apprehending the world. They always wanted to eliminate these to make way for some universalistic grand project that was going to remake the world wholesale. But Burke is fairly moderate next to some of the other figures I look at. Somebody like Joseph de Maistre, for example, insists that reason, or what is sometimes called philosophy, is an utterly impotent tool. What we need to do instead is put our faith in authority and in traditional forms of authority, especially in his case, you know, the throne and altar of France. And he says that if we need to use force in order to demand that people acquiesce to these forms of authority and the outlooks associated with them, then so be it, because the alternative, if reason is allowed to have too much of a power, is going to be chaos, since each person understands reason to signify or to imply something different. And then I go forward looking at some more contemporary figures, someone like Michael Oakeshott, who's most famous for his essay, Rationalism and Politics. He makes the argument that conservatism entails a wholesale rejection of, at the very least, utilitarian or calculative forms of rationality. And he makes the argument instead that what we need to do is have a politics of faith, faith that our traditions are better, faith in our ways of thinking about things, the languages that we use. And this is very, very proximate to the work of any number of postmodern theorists, I should say. Richard Rorty is probably the most obvious. And it's yet another sign of how amenable conservatism is to mutation into postmodern forms under the right conditions. And then this analysis or genealogy ends with a look at two figures I spent quite some time with, since my background is in legal studies. So Robert Bork and Lord Devlin, who were two conservative legal theorists in the late 20th century. Devlin famously argued against Professor Hart that homosexuality should remain criminalized. And his essays make the claim, or his lectures, I should say, that liberals always have these weird rationalistic ways of looking at things, and they try to appeal to evidence and universalistic standards to make the claim that we should adopt liberal policies. And he said that's not how society should be organized. The way society should be organized is according to the views of what he called the man on the Clapham omnibus. The man on the Clapham omnibus being the right-minded figure who more or less shares the mores and expectations of his society. And Devlin goes so far as to say the man on the Clapham omnibus whose views should pervade and cross society doesn't even have to be right. He doesn't have to have his views grounded in anything more substantial than just a gut feeling that this is the correct thing to do. Because criticizing him or saying that he needs to ground his views in more than just a gut feeling has a kind of anti-democratic or anti-populist sentiment. And Bork makes very similar arguments when he talks about the new class, which are a bunch of intellectuals he thinks are pervasive in American law schools and American culture, who insist that we should reform the world in line with some universalistic concepts of reason. And Bork says, no, you know, we shouldn't do that. We should instead have what he calls respect for particularity, which is difference, history, culture, tradition. And his argument is that conservatism is precisely about having respect for these relative cultural forms of particularism and rejecting the grand universalistic narrative of something like reason, which, of course, would be absolutely in line with what somebody like Michel Foucault would want in some of his moments at the very least, except, of course, interpreted in a very different political manner.
Moving forward and turning to who we might consider the first postmodern conservative and who you just recently alluded to, you look at the work and ideas of Peter Lawler, who gets his understanding of postmodernism from a variety of figures we might not immediately turn to, including St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. So his understanding of postmodernism is maybe a bit different than what we might immediately assume. So can you give us a sense of what his own philosophical or political orientation here is?
Yeah, I should say that I think Lawler is a very smart man. I disagree with him fundamentally, but he certainly was an eclectic and interesting scholar. He wasn't afraid of pushing boundaries. And one of the ways he pushes boundaries is by reinterpreting postmodernism in a way that might be counterintuitive to many. So his argument is that modernity is defined by a break, particularly from Catholic scholasticism and the idea that the ontology of the world is solid and set because God created the world and God continuously interacts with the world to make sure everything is more or less going the way it's supposed to. In modernity, when we abandon this teleological way of thinking about things, we're left with the notion that, well, there are no rules embedded in nature and there's certainly no rules set down by God, so we can recreate the world and we can recreate ourselves to be whatever we want. And Lawler points to transhumanism, for example, as a very distinctively hypermodern, is the term he uses, innovation in that respect. The idea that there is no human nature, there is no human body even, that necessarily needs to be one thing or another. If we can use technology to change and improve in it in a way that's consonant with our subjective desires, why not go about doing that? And what Lawler calls postmodernism would be rejection of this hypermodern subjectivist outlook. And he interpreted postmodernism as a return to something that would be closer to a neo-scholasticism. And it would be much more oriented around virtues. It would accept the contributions of modernity while at the same time looking past and gradually abandoning its limitations. He never laid out his vision for what a postmodern conservative society would look at systematically, or at least as systematically as I would have liked. But you can read about it in a number of his essays. His book on virtue, I think, is particularly useful there.
Looking at postmodern conservatism, you see it as expressing a sort of pastiche, to borrow Frederick Jameson's term, and generating its own version of identity politics, appropriating progressive language for reactionary politics that seem closer to Schmitt or Nietzsche. So can you unpack the dynamic going on here?
Of course. So one of the things that I draw upon is Nietzsche's theory of resentment and Carl Schmitt's theory of political antagonism. Although I should point out that this is very much a left-wing reading of Nietzsche that would be more in line with the thinking of somebody like Wendy Brown, who I think is the best critical theorist working in the world today, bar none. And she talks about how it is that Nietzsche had a very elitist understanding of resentment. Resentment was the feeling of the weak towards the powerful, and their desire, put it colloquially, to put the powerful in their place. And Nietzsche talks, for instance, about how in the work of early Christian theorists, when the poor are in heaven looking down upon the rich and the sinners in hell and laughing at them, this expresses resentment of the weak towards the powerful. Brown makes the argument, and I think that she's very right, that resentment can absolutely be resentment of the powerful towards the weak or towards the disadvantaged who want their fair share of the pot, as it were. And you see this with many Trumpist supporters who often come from positions of relative affluence and privilege, not typically extraordinary affluence and privilege, but relative affluence and privilege. And they deeply resent the arguments made that they should redistribute power and privileges that they've enjoyed to individuals and groups that have long been disadvantaged by the status quo. And you can think of people like women, you can think about things like LGBTQ individuals, migrants, obviously a very popular one that I talked about in the book, liberals, liberal elites. And what I argue is that the resentment generated by the powerful towards the weak, who want their fair share of the pie, leads postmodern conservatives to take an agonistic approach to politics that's broadly in line with Carl Schmitt's theory of how it is that politics operate. So postmodern conservatives, as I mentioned, see the world in terms of identity and power. And they believe that they are entitled to most of the power in society, that these other groups that want to take it from them or redistribute it are wrong. And this leads them to embrace a political outlook that's framed on the friend-enemy distinction. So they're most concerned with aligning with other postmodern conservatives who share their outlook about the world. And they tend to see anybody who doesn't get on board with their outlook as an antagonist who needs to be overcome or marginalized. And this is partly why they give their such faith to leaders like Donald Trump or Viktor Orban, who similarly frame in politics in this very agonistic way, them us fashion, precisely because these authoritarian or authoritarian-leaning figures, their primary appeal is, of course, that they're going to own or trash or destroy the enemies of the postmodern conservative.
Yeah, following up on what you were just developing there, turning to more contemporary expressions of postmodern conservatism, you look at various responses to the 2008 fiscal crisis, such as the rise of Viktor Orban and later Donald Trump, Jair Bolsonaro, and the Brexit movement. You argue that these were reactions to a serious desperation and precarity produced by decades of neoliberal austerity programs, albeit reactions that missed the mark. However, one theme you see connecting them is that they are all modern variations of postmodern conservatism. So can you pull them together and explain how these various movements and figures function as postmodern reactions to late capitalism?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I point out is that postmodern conservatism as a form of conservatism that's very much based on the traditions and outlooks of each respective society doesn't look exactly the same anywhere. Liberalism tends to have more unanimity or consistency of application because neoliberalism is a universalistic theory. And postmodern conservatism tends to be much more of a pastiche-like sense of what people's identities are, drawing on a variety of different anachronistic cultural sources and blended together in this hyper-real way. So in the case of somebody like Donald Trump, what you have is it's very distinctively American form of postmodern conservatism that's based around bluster and paranoia. And the two go together since, of course, bluster is the twin cousin of paranoia, since it's only by overcoming tremendous enemies that are extremely ubiquitous and very frightening that you can develop this posture of yourself as a big man who's accomplished, who's beaten the odds and transformed yourself into something that's more impressive than usual. It's also a distinctively American form of postmodern conservatism, since Trump elides the distinction that we usually draw between telling the truth and telling a lie, because he embraces a bullshit approach to speaking and to the truth. And this is actually a technical term drawn from Harry Frankfurt, who distinguished between dishonesty and bullshit by saying that a dishonest person is aware of what the truth is and nonetheless decides to lie about it. And his example was Richard Nixon. And a dishonest person is, in this sense, easier to catch because he or she themselves is aware at some level that they are misrepresenting reality, and this can generate feelings of guilt or anxiety. Whereas a bullshitter is indifferent to the very idea of reality itself. They think that reality should more or less be what they make of it. And since what they want to make of it changes day in and day out, they have no concern about moving from different positions day in, day out, in order to, if that coincides with their own subjective opinions and desires at any given time. And of course, this is Trump to a T, right? And it's also very much an outlook that's embedded in American culture, which has many type of capitalist propensities, which are highly amenable to a bullshit way of approaching the world. Somebody like Viktor Orban comes from a very different standpoint, but still constitutes a form of postmodern conservatism, or so I argue. So Viktor Orban, for those who don't know, is the Hungarian leader of the Fidesz party. They took power in 2010, and just recently, actually, suspended any number of democratic rights in the country, with Orban more or less ruling as a modern-day dictator. The way that Orban has framed his postmodern conservatism, like Trump, is as a skepticism of liberal elites and a skepticism of universalistic projects, for instance, like the European Union or like liberalism. This hasn't kept him, of course, from taking billions of dollars from the European Union, where that's advantageous. But that's neither here nor there, of course. And Orban has focused on restoring a peculiarly Catholic or Christian interpretation of the Hungarian identity and establishing what he calls an illiberal form of democracy, where the real people of Hungary, who are of course not the people in Budapest or at the Central European University or so on and so forth, will finally have their say and will be able to ostracize all the foreign or antagonistic elements and ideally either drive them out of the country or silence them once and for all. And this is a peculiarly postmodern phenomenon, of course, because Orban uses every trick in the book to undermine the claims of universalistic region. He is well known for distorting the truth and undermining other truth-telling institutions, whether the media or the judicial system. And it's also a postmodern phenomena with the skepticism he shows towards any kinds of claims that contravene this very identity-driven narrative that he puts forward as central to modern Hungarian politics.
One interesting, although somewhat disturbing, comment you make in the book is that many people who support these figures will continue to support them even if and as they fail to come through on their promises of material stability and safety, since there's a parallel promise of stability at the level of personal and social identity that will nonetheless be fulfilled. Can you unpack this dynamic here?
Yeah, implicit in this is a critique of what I might call the orthodox Marxist view or orthodox socialist view, that people are driven exclusively or primarily by what's sometimes called interest or human interest, to use Jürgen Habermas's term. And this means their material interest, right? They want to be better off at the end of the day in material terms than they were at the start of the day. And I see this as too simplistic, although and still very popular, unfortunately. People are driven by a lot more than just their material interests, particularly in a postmodern culture. What people are also driven by is this need to have a strong sense of who they are and what it is that they should value, and of course, why their life may or may not be valuable. And integrating yourself into this cheesy narrative of being a heroic figure, standing against the tide of Islam, or fighting against overeducated liberal elites on behalf of the average person, which of course isn't the average person, really. It's a reasonably well-off white male, typically in his 30s or 40s, sometimes older. This is a very powerful narrative for a lot of people that they want to feel themselves to be part of. And because they've also been primed to see any counter argument or counterclaim as ultimately something to be dismissed with skepticism because it comes from liberal elites or it's agitating on behalf of migrants or whatever, you're not going to see them deviating from this very often. Precisely because the narrative that they're driven by is so powerful and so important in stabilizing their identity, and also because the people who usually put forward counter narratives and claim are those they view as their fundamental antagonists and so are disinclined to believe under any and all circumstances. Now, saying that, I do think that we're finally starting to see a few breaks in the kind of structure of the postmodern conservative mentality because of the COVID-19 crisis. You've seen that Trump's reaction to it has been very widely criticized, and his polling numbers have been dropping precipitously, even amongst people typically inclined to support the Republican Party. And the reason, I think, is because you can bullshit your way past a lot of things. You can bullshit your way past throwing children into cages. You can apparently bullshit your way out of talking about a hurricane that's going to blow up towns on its path of destruction. But it's very difficult to bullshit your way past the possibility of mass death from a virus that spreads very rapidly and has the potential to kill many thousands, if not millions, of people. So whether that means that Trump is going to lose an election, lose the election in 2020, I don't know. But certainly we've been seeing that his usual tactics are less effective than they have been in the past. And I really hope that that continues to be the case. Although at the same time, you know, I do hope that he does eventually improve his behavior a little bit to try to save more lives wherever possible.
Coming up on the end of the book, you've given us a rather rich and compelling history of the last several decades, helping us understand the appeal of many contemporary political and cultural figures. So obviously you can't be expected to have all the answers on how to deal with this, but at least to give us some vague sense of what is to be done, what do progressive movements need to offer so that postmodern conservatism isn't the only game in town for making sense of and responding to late capitalism?
Well, I put forward a few different possible solutions. All of this will be elaborated in a lot more detail in my forthcoming book, Liberalism and Liberal Rights, A Critical Legal Argument, that I'm just finishing up now. But the two big ones, I guess I'll just end on that, are I think that progressives need to abandon this kind of elitist commitment to institutional reform, which is driven broadly Rawlsian or social democratic left for a long time. And what I mean by this is the notion that elites, particularly technocratic elites, in positions of power, should use institutions to shift the way the world operates and establish more egalitarian outcomes. And these are usually top-down projects like the European Union, or like the establishment of many welfare states in a European, or for that matter, in a Canadian or British context, to a lesser extent, the United States. And the problem with this is it's insufficiently participatory to allow people the sense that they themselves are building a better world and a more fair society. And this makes it very easy for reactionary pundits to frame these efforts to establish more egalitarian outcomes as some kind of snooty project that's being driven by people with useless degrees who've never worked a day in their lives. And they're taking money and resources from hardworking people to give it to migrants and other people who don't deserve to be there. Now, a lot of this is, of course, bullshit in the technical sense that I'm talking about. And it's used as a screen to solidify power in the hands of those who really do hold the levers of society in their hands. But it is an effective and simple narrative that the left can't actually contravene by continuing on the path of undemocratic institutionalism from the top. So that's one of the criticisms that I make. The second criticism that I make, proposal, is that we need a restoration of the more down-to-earth egalitarianism that we saw characterizing progressive politics in the 1950s. And what I mean by down-to-earth is achieving egalitarian distributions of goods, resources, and honors, but in a way that's much more tangible and much more driven by a powerful solidaristic narrative than what we've seen with technocratic institutionalism. So for instance, if you look at something like the Beveridge Report in the 1940s, which is when national healthcare was instituted in the United States, this is very much framed as a communal project that was going to establish a fairer society in a context where Great Britain had just won a very long and very difficult war against Nazi Germany. And we needed to establish a kind of post-war society that wasn't going to be riven by the tensions and inequalities of the earlier ones, because this was just fair and is what people deserved after everything they've gone through. And I don't think that's what you see with a lot of these technocratic projects. Again, they're very much driven, technocratic egalitarian projects. They're very much pushed by the top. And I think what we should see more is trying to sell people on the idea of more egalitarian outcomes in a way that's grounded in their traditions, grounded in their democratic national outlooks, and that resonates with them symbolically and narratively in a way that you saw previously with something like the NHS.
Yeah, sounds very interesting. So, Matt McManus, thank you so much for being with us.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me. And I hope everyone's keeping safe, and hopefully we'll all get through this relatively unscathed and we start interacting with our friends again. That'd be nice.
I look forward to it. So, thank you.